Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people. Welcome back, everyone, to season 3 of Remember What's Next with Rabbi Ken Spiro and myself, Ellie Bass. We're super excited to be back, and I think we're going to be delving into some really gnarly topics this season, but we're focusing on mainly Jewish values in a world of modernity. We're going to talk about division. We're going to talk about unity. We're going to talk about mission and purpose. But really the focus for season 3 is understanding how do we live as Jews with an ancient code of ethics in a modern world that sometimes clashes with those ethics and is often enhanced by it. So we're going to try to delve into that topic. Anything else you want to say about that, Ken, before we jump in?
Nope. That sounds good, but like we say, there's nothing new under the sun. So all the challenges we're facing today, we have past precedents for better and for worse that give us the keys to navigating through what is going on for sure.
Absolutely. So we're going to start off this season because the holiday of Purim is around the corner, and there's tremendous upheaval happening right now in Tel Aviv and Israel with these ongoing protests that are going on, which we'll go into a little bit. But really, we're going to use those as a focus to look back historically at times where when have we been divided and when have we been unified, and why is that important for us in terms of our mission and purpose as Jews in the modern world? So where should we start?
Well, first of all, let me just give a little, you mentioned Tel Aviv. Let me just a little bit overview, because then we're going to go back.
Yes, please.
The issue is basically over the new government, which is a right-wing government with a lot of religious parties in it, is pushing an agenda. The number one agenda that the opposition, which is more the left side of Israel's political spectrum, is opposed to is a judicial reform, how the Supreme Court justices in Israel are selected. In Israel, it's a kind of unique system. The judges get to pick other judges without any kind of external review. So they're trying to undo that, and people are yelling that it's going to threaten the whole essence of Israeli democracy. It's become a very heated debate. And right now, literally, as we are speaking, it's going on. The Knesset debates are happening today, the voting, and the the government, because it's a parliamentary system, has the ability legally to vote those changes into law. And the opposition is doing their best to try and stop it or to create some sort of compromise. And it's just gotten kind of out of control. So not just in Tel Aviv, it's all over the country. As a matter of fact, tonight it's taking place in Jerusalem because that's where the Knesset meets. But today in Tel Aviv, there was very large rallies that got quite disruptive, trying to block streets. And they were actually broke out the big heavy guns, so to speak, with they're using water cannons, something I have not seen used in Tel Aviv ever, even stun grenades and stuff like that. I mean, there weren't a lot of injuries, but tensions are running high and the country is very divided at the moment, very much so, which is never good. And already I know our enemies are gloating about it. I know in Iran they're having a field day with this,
because for sure
we're gonna implode. So that's sort of a little background to what's going on now in Israel.
When's the last time that you remember seeing this type of division in Israel?
So there's been periods that there's always the political unrest is not something new. It happens in Israel all the time. And, you know, you're more accustomed to seeing this with the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel doing this in terms of issues related to the army and drafting or arresting someone in Mea Shearim. And there it gets actually worse. The police, the confrontations get worse. The damage, destruction is worse. But I cannot remember anything quite this intense. I mean, when I first came here after the Lebanon War, there was a lot of opposition to that. So, like big protests. It was sort of like Israel's Vietnam moment.
And how? So that was 1970.
That was in the '80s.
Okay.
'80s. My camera's gone nuts here. Is that gonna? Is this being video recorded or just?
No, we're good. We can still hear you.
Okay. So, yeah. But I mean, that it definitely has been off and on things, but this is the most. This is the opposition is really pulling out all the stops. So the level of protest, it's been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks now.
So historically, how do we generally deal with division in our camps? I mean, I think we already know that as Jews, we're not an easy people to get on the same page with almost anything. So generally, how do we function as a Jewish people when we're divided, and why does that sort of almost go against the whole mission of the Jewish people in the first place?
I mean, you're focusing on something that's really important to understand. I mean, unity in general is important for any country. Lincoln had that great line during the Civil War, which is actually from the Christian Bible, but a house divided against itself cannot stand. So the amount of energy that is wasted and even self-destructive, you know, things that happen in civil wars, or even if it's not that extreme, divisiveness within society can be very, very destructive. We see this not just in Israel. You're seeing it reflected in the United States today very much. So the division, the world in general is very, very split. But the Jewish people in particular, because we're a people with a unique historic mission, our greatest strength, which enabled us to be the people to bring this sort of ideas and mission into the world, is also has a flip side to it. It's a double-edged sword. You know, and I'm speaking kind of vaguely, but what I'm talking about is our job is to really transform the world based on the idea of one God, which is today an idea accepted by billions of people. You know, a God-given standard of morality, a deterministic view of history, that there's a higher being controlling the story, that stuff. It all comes from Judaism. And, you know, before Abraham came into the world, everyone in the world was religious, but they were all polytheistic cultures that believed in a world full of gods. And pretty much they would swap their gods like baseball cards. and along comes Abraham, who I think is the most radically transformative thinker in human history. And he comes up with a completely counterintuitive and unacceptable idea of an infinite, invisible being outside of time and space. See, to come up with such an idea, you got to be a radically transformative thinker.
Right.
But the real power of Abraham, which is the power of the Jewish people, which is not a trait that's unique to us, but we seem to have it in spades, as they say, a tremendous amount of it, is to be very driven and very stubborn in our ideology. Because to push radically transformative ideas that no one wants to listen to and most people will kill you for, you got to be pretty dedicated to what you believe in and be willing to even put your life on the line for it. So that is sort of like the collective personality trait of the Jewish people. When I'm saying collective traits, I mean everyone, every human being is different, like a snowflake. But the Jews have sort of collective personality traits that embody the Jewish people more so than other groups of people. Radically transformative thinking. There are non-Jews who are definitely radically transformative, but Jews are disproportionately so. And driven is a character trait that is overwhelmingly part of the Jewish personality, for better or for worse.
Right.
But it creates people who are very individualistic, very nonconformist, and therefore very fractious, and therefore incredibly hard to lead, because leadership depends on being able to govern a group of people in a harmonious way, where they're all kind of on the same page. And that's always, always, always been a massive challenge for the Jewish people.
I think if we even think spiritually about, you know, how Judaism is sort of built in terms of a worldview, everything that we do is about uniting opposites, right? Like taking two seemingly totally dissonant things and shoving them into like relationship with each other, right? Whether it's like humans with like an omnipresent God, or a body, physical body that suddenly has a soul, or like, you know, that we're constantly trying to figure out how to make relationships between things that supposedly shouldn't have a relationship. It should be divisive, but we're always looking to unify things. And it seems like built into like how we think as Jews, even if we look at our liturgy and our literature, you know, the Talmud is filled with arguments that are working towards some unified theory of how to practice something that seemingly doesn't necessarily go together. So I think it's so cool when we talk about this intrinsic part of the Jewish people, that not only are we stubborn and driven, but we also like are always trying to figure out like what's option C, where these things go together, but make something totally new that unifies us in a way that we weren't before. So I think it's a really cool way of looking at things, but it doesn't always work and we don't always get to see, and we do often end up at each other's throats, or like that joke that you mentioned, right? Like, you know, two Jews, three shuls, the one that no one goes to, and you know, generally not speaking to each other and being in conflict. So how have we navigated that in the past, and what are some of the things that have worked or not worked?
Sure. Well, I mean, you're right, because, you know, the whole idea of being pulled in different directions is precisely what gives us choice. Otherwise, we're automatons. You know, the body and the soul, for instance. We are the sum total of the choices we make, and to have choices, you have to have things to choose between. And to have things to choose between, you have to be pulled in different directions. So it's not a bad thing for people to want different things, but it's a question of keeping the goal in mind. That's the real problem. Rabbi Noach Weinberg, you know, the founder of Eshet Torah, my rabbi, he had a great line. He said, all men of good intention will reason together and come to a common conclusion. So if your goal is to get to the truth, which is what all Talmudic debate is about, even this is why the Talmud will often debate things that are completely theoretical, because they want to get to a principle that has to do with something related to understanding truth and reality. So that's fine to do that. But when you're arguing aside for the sake of arguing aside, when ego gets in there and people aren't on the same page, that's when it can be incredibly divisive, destructive. You know, struggles for power, for instance, it's me being in charge versus you being in charge. There's no common denominator there, except that both people want power, but neither want to share it with the other.
Right.
So what's really fundamental to all of this is the problem with the Jewish people, is especially when you have a group of people who are very passionate, very driven, very individualistic, don't like to conform. If they're not on the same page, that will cause hyper divisive person behavior.
Yeah.
And we see that from the very beginning of who we are as a people, you know, that's always been the challenge. You know, at Mount Sinai, for instance, which is arguably the greatest moment of Jewish history and human history, the national revelation, you know, the famous statement, V'yichana am neged achar, that the people camped against the mountain. And it's in the singular, and Rashi, the great medieval commentator, jumps in and yells out, you know, he says, Ish echad b'lev echad. Everyone was on the same page. One man with one heart. And when we all want the same thing, then it's just a question of discussing, you know, how to get there, what the most efficient way of doing that is. So that definitely is point number one. And unfortunately, in the Jewish world today, you could say on the deepest level, all human beings really want the same things. But practically speaking, on a day-to-day level, Jews and most people in the world are very interested in very different things. Their vision of what the world should be like, their vision of what kind of government they have, their vision of personal autonomy and sexual preference and everything. These are all factors that are just further dividing people, which is what the real, think about it, what Judaism is essentially about ultimately is we're all into one thing, relationship with God.
Right.
And if all people were into that relationship with God, and I always take that John Lennon song, Imagine, which is the best worst song ever written.
Right.
I love it, but it's horrible. It's so antithetical to Judaism.
Right.
Nothing to live or die for, the brotherhood of man, all these things that are so not. But just, I would say, change the words around. Imagine all humanity working together to get to the highest level of pleasure, which is connection to the infinite. You know, that's the messianic era. That's what it's all about. But to do that, you gotta all be on the same page, and you gotta suspend things like ego.
And I also think, like, sometimes, you know, we're supposed to balance. We're supposed to have a balanced relationship between our relationship with God, our relationship with each other, and our relationship with ourselves. And if one of those is out of balance, the whole, you know, chair is about to, you know, tip over. And I think a lot of the time, the conflict that we get into, it doesn't have anything to do with God. It has to do with, you know, whether or not we're able to regulate and deal with ourselves, or, you know, can I have difficult conversations with people and make that productive instead of destructive? And the God piece is really just supposed to, not just supposed to, but it's one of the pieces is just so we all remember, we all have someone above us. So like, if you think we're going to get into some kind of power dynamic between us, we are all under God, which is, you know, the kind of ultimate leveling factor between peoples. But I think we, you know, the relationship piece is something that we really, really struggle with. And I think going back to what you said about Sinai being the place where we were the most, say, unified, it's all sort of downhill from there, because once we get to Judges, like we get to Shoftim, we get to Judges, we get to all the kingdoms of Israel, we're in trouble. So like, what happens in that period of time where, you know, like our pattern becomes disunity?
Right. So there, I mean, first of all, you have to focus on Moses, who's the ultimate Jewish leader, the highest level of prophecy. Mm-hmm. Well, the greatness of Moses is a really indication of what we need. Moses is, you know, people always say, it says in the Bible, Moses was Anav Mikol Adam, the most humble of all people. People say, oh, that's proof that Moses didn't write the Bible. First of all, Moses doesn't write the Bible. God dictates it to him. He's the scribe and God is the author. But the most humble of all men would never say I'm the most humble of all men, because we have humility is like, no, I'm not so great. No, humility is absolute honest recognition of who you are. And Moses right. is the best example of that. When he comes down from Mount Sinai, he's almost see-through. That's how little ego he has. He has to wear a mask on his face, you know? So he is the example of what leadership is about. He's a selfless person, servant of God, who just wants to connect God's children to God and be the conduit for that. No ego in there at all. Whereas Korach in the Bible, which is the first really major revolt you have, which takes place in the 40 years of wandering in the desert, who is from the tribe of Levi, he's a cousin of Moses's, you know, he ostensibly says, you know, we're all like the same family, we're all holy, and why do you take upon yourself this authority? And he challenges him, like, mm-hmm. you've taken upon too much power concentrated. Now, Moses is not interested in power. Moses is only interested in doing the will of God. Korach, you can see, there's a guy who pays lip service to the mission, but really it's all about ego. He's already dropped the ball, so to speak.
Right.
You know, he wants power. So now I'm in there. And I need power. So I'm going to hide behind some ideology or some seemingly altruistic motive, but really it's not what it's about. And that's the kind of stuff. And you see how horrified Moses is about that.
Yeah.
Anything to avoid. But this is what plagues the Jewish people after the golden calf story. We have the famous Midrash from Shmot Rabbah, Midrash in the rabbinic literature that gives us much deeper understanding of the stories in the Bible. And it says that there are three who are inherently chutzpahdik, amongst the dog amongst the animals, the rooster amongst the birds, and the Jew amongst the nations. You know, chutzpah is that word. It means audacity, gumption, spunk, nerve. He says, and then the Midrash goes on. This is a very profound statement, because it's being said, you know, 1800 years ago. You might think this is something negative, but it's really praise for a Jew who would rather be hanged than give up his Judaism. So
right.
We're being told that this is the essential trait. This is the trait of Abraham and Sarah. This is that complete dedication to God at all costs, truth regardless of consequences. That's precisely what is needed to be a teeny people that is so transformative in human history, to lose so many battles, but win the war ultimately, and to be able to outlast all of these people, including great empires that tried to destroy us, because we just are not going to budge from we know to what be true.
Right.
But that's when we're truly into truth and truly dedicated. But when not, then you end just up getting this crazy, fractious people who, rather than being into truth, are what we know. We all know an argument. The Torah talks all about the argument for the sake of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
The truth. But most people, anyone who knows about how people argue and is into psychology, knows that ego is the biggest obstacle to coming to agreement.
Right.
I'm right, because if I'm wrong, that's somehow a reflection on who I am or something about me. So when ego gets in there, we see ego is insanely destructive in general, but very, very destructive to the Jewish people. And when Jews, sometimes very close together, I'm not talking about radically different, like an extreme left wing versus an extreme right wing Jew,
yeah.
extreme secular versus religious. Sometimes right. Jews who are very, very religious and you can barely tell them apart externally, are arguing over very small things like my rabbi is the rabbi, and that leads to even sometimes even violent confrontations between people. So just because it doesn't have to be based on massive differences, what it does have to be based on is, it doesn't matter what so much we're arguing on, but whether we're willing to put our egos aside and really listen to what the other side has to say, which is the famous discussion between the students of Hillel and Shammai, who were two great rabbis who headed the Sanhedrin 2,000 years ago, who's had, it's called Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. It doesn't mean, it means a house of Shammai and the house of Hillel. It doesn't mean they were literally houses, but they were schools of thought. They each had their teacher, their progenitor, who their students, and they tended to follow the legal interpretations of their teacher. And Shammai is always known to be the harsher of the two, and Hillel is the more, I would say, more lenient, generally speaking, but more inclusive. And we go according to, and they're always debating in the Talmud, and we go according to Hillel in almost every single case. Beit Hillel, and his opinion is followed. Not because there's not,
right,
there's not legitimacy to the opinion of Shammai, but then the Talmud goes on to explain, why do we follow Hillel over Shammai? It's because when they would debate, they would always bring up the opposition's argument first. Like, I sincerely want to hear what you have to say, as opposed to shouting you down, which is, by the way, look what goes on in the world today.
Right.
You know, it used to be, you know, when I used to debate things like the Israeli-Palestinian issue, people would heckle me. Now it's just cancel culture. Now we don't want to hear what to say. You don't have a right to your opinion unless you agree with mine.
Right.
Which is incredibly destructive.
I always love the example of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, just as a modern example of having difficult conversations and respecting each other, even if we have different ways of understanding things or different opinions. You know, I remember there was a great talk that I heard by Caitlin Flanagan, who writes for The Atlantic. And she talks about how she was talking about the abortion debate. And she was saying, if each side of the debate were to hear the best arguments of each other, they would probably find they had much more in common than they did different. But we don't do that. We hear the worst arguments on the other side and then basically just pummel each other into the ground to say, you either agree with me or I'm never speaking to you again. And I love that we have an example Jewishly in our history of two houses who radically interpret how to practice Torah differently, and yet marry each other's daughters, eat at each other's tables, and welcome the arguments of the other as just as intellectual, spiritual, and good arguments, just disagreeing on how to do it. I think it's just unprecedented right now in the world as we see it today.
Right. And it's the notion that discussion, well, argument is a dangerous word, but you know, debate back and forth is extremely healthy, and it's very good. It's how you get to the essential principles and ideas of anything. And Judaism values that tremendously, which is why Jewish learning is extremely interactive and challenging, and why that joke is, what's the answer to a Jewish question? Another question.
Right.
The famous Rabbi Yochanan, was a very famous rabbi also 2,000 years ago, and his chavrusa was Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish was originally a gladiator and a highway robber who has a complete about face and becomes a great rabbi, and he's the chavrusa of Rabbi Yochanan. And when Reish Lakish dies, Rabbi Yochanan had such a brilliant mind and so loved the challenge of the discussion, because this was his best friend, his learning partner, his chavrusa, as we say, that he was so depressed when he lost this guy, because he didn't want a yes man. He wanted some, so they went and got him someone else to learn with him. And it says for every point that Rabbi Yochanan made, this guy would give 10 supports for it. Like, you're right, right. And he couldn't take it. He didn't want anyone telling him he was right. He wanted someone to, because they wanted to argue for the sake of truth. And basically, he went nuts. Mm-hmm. And it's a wild story. And the rabbis prayed that he should just die, because he's just in such pain. He needs to leave. They didn't do anything to kill him physically. But he lost that challenge. He lost we see this, people get old there when they stop interacting with the world, and it's kind of like slowly tune out and dry up and disappear.
Right.
But this is we need to really distinguish between the notion of the search for truth, of arguing over things, but always doing it out of having the same goal in mind, that our goal is not who's right, but our goal is what's true.
Yeah.
And that I, and it's always respecting the other person and never taking it personally, which is very easy to say and very hard to do.
And also really hard to imagine role models in the modern world today, in the modern Jewish world today, who represent that search for truth rather than being right. It's very hard to think of people in leadership roles that really personify that these
right.
days.
Who put the greater good above their personal ego. And we see, but this fractiousness will haunt the Jewish people. You know, you fast forward, but Purim, we had unity. You know, we had the Jewish people split after the death of King Solomon, two kingdoms, and both become vassal states of the Assyrian Empire. They fight with each other, and they eventually go into exile. We fast forward to the Second Temple period, when the Jews rebel against the oppressive occupation of the Romans in the year 66. And when the Romans come back with four legions to reconquer the land, the Jews are fighting a civil war over, and it's not like extremist Jews, like the left versus the right. These are groups of what are called zealots, Bilyonim, Sicarii, different groups of mostly religious nationalist groups who are killing each other off. And, you know, over like who's going to be in charge, who's right, who's going to lead. They even get to the point where the Romans finally surround Jerusalem. They burn the food supplies in the city. The zealots do it.
Right.
This is Josephus's account. You know, we don't want to. We don't want Jews to sit behind the walls and with on their fat stomachs and just try and outlast the Romans. If we like burn the food, then they'll be desperate and they'll fight more desperately. This is we literally. When do they stop fighting? When the Romans breach the walls of the city and it's too little, too late. We're going to be overrun by, you know, 40,000 Roman soldiers. Then too little, too late. Then we stop fighting. But in the end, what happens? It ends in absolute disaster. You fast forward to Bar Kokhba, which Shimon Bar Kokhba from 132 to 135 CE, although that revolt did fail, it seems to have had much more support and unity around him, which is why he raises this. We lack a lot of details about the struggle, but he seemed to have raised a massive army. And they ejected the Romans from Israel and had an independent state for several years, which was unprecedented
at
the time of the Roman Empire. You know, it seems that ego got in there in the end and things fell apart. But when the Jewish people are united, you know, we're like an unstoppable force. And there's so many examples in both directions.
So when's the last time that we really, I think, felt united? Like, I know there are momentary experiences, right? Like Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz in his one of his talks at the 92nd Street Y, he talked about us like as a family, right? Like we kick each other under the table and pull each other's ears, but when something bad happens, right, then we come together. And we have had all of us experiences of a day or two or a week or two when, God forbid, Jews are in under threat, whether it's in, you know, the diaspora or in Israel, where suddenly everybody's on this, mostly everybody is on the same page. But again, once the threat dissipates, we sort of go back to, you know, pulling on each other's ears and kicking each other under the table is a nicer way of saying it. So when's the last time we were really united? And what does the Purim story have to teach us about what that could look like?
Sure. By the way, it's funny you say that about when things. One of the reasons I understand why we get put in the worst neighborhood in the world, which is the Middle East, is precisely because if things are really quiet around here, we'd rip each other apart. And I say it's sort of half sarcastically cynical, almost funny, but that's the external threat that when things go too far, something always bumps in. First of all, when Israel was founded as a state in the ashes of the Holocaust, there was almost across the board support of all Jews in the world for a Jewish state and the recognition. We absolutely have to have it. There's a great book by Leonard Slater called The Pledge. It's a really must-read book about what Israel did, what the Jewish world did to support Israel. You know, there's an international arms embargo and how even the Jews involved in organized crime in America who were teamed up with the Italians who ran like the Teamsters unions and loaded the ships, how they arranged that ships were going to be the arms to be smuggled to Egypt. They would load them up onto ships, sending these arms to Israel, that kind of thing. So in those situations, there's a great example. The War of Independence was, with certain exceptions, a great example of when we were, you know, a third of the Jews in the world were dead. Israel surrounded by six Arab armies declaring war. It's 45 million Arabs against 600,000 Jews. Israel has no tanks, no air force. This is mostly we had pretty good across the board universal support. Within Israel, however, it wasn't so clear. Everyone should read the story of the Altalena, you know, the Irgun, which was the breakaway Zionist movement that was
Right.
founded by Zev Jabotinsky in, you know, in the earlier part of the, during the British Mandate, around in I think the late 1920s, early 1930s, when it was founded. And at the time of the War of Independence, it was Menachem Begin, who later became prime minister, was running the Irgun. They brought a ship in with refugees and a lot of weapons, which were desperately needed. And at
Right.
this time, there was no unified fighting force.
This was the Irgun and the Haganah,
the Irgun,
right?
And this, well, this is the Irgun and the main, which is a breakaway Zionist organization that had its own fighting unit, Etzel, which was had their own military units. And then you had, you know, the Haganah, which had subunits, the Palmach, but the Haganah became, is the mainstream fighting organization of the Labor Zionist Party that was run by David Ben-Gurion. And the ship gets to the coast. They unload the refugees. And then there was a discussion about where the weapons were going to go. And Begin did a deal with Ben-Gurion about what percentage. Anyway, it's a complicated story. But in the end, Ben-Gurion did not accept what Begin wanted to do. And he gave orders to Yitzhak Rabin to open fire on the ship.
Wow.
Off the coast of Tel Aviv. Begin was on the ship, by the way. I think it was 12, 13 people were killed. Begin wasn't injured. They arrested a whole bunch of the people afterwards, and it came within a hair's breadth of a civil war. Now, Begin is a great example of a Jewish leader who said, under no circumstance are we going to have a civil war, meaning I'm putting my ego in. And by the way, anyone who reads about Menachem Begin realizes he was a real giant. He wasn't physically a giant, but he is a giant of Jewish leadership in terms of understanding what's at stake and never letting his ego. He was a very, very humble human being, never letting his ego get in the way. And we could have had there a civil war within Israel right at the time when we were almost being destroyed by the Arabs. But we also see that I you know, in situations where I had both my oldest son was a sniper and a medic in the paratroopers and fought as a drafted soldier in the first 2008-2009 war in Gaza. And then my younger son was in a reservist who did 38 days in Gaza in 2014, was it? I can't keep track of so many of these wars. But it's interesting how you see, first of all, he was telling me internally what it was like, how everyone was on the same page.
Right.
Yeah, they were sending tzitzit, you know, the fringes. They were sending pairs, and every soldier said was taking them. Even the secondary soldiers. It's like my spiritual bulletproof vest.
Wow.
Everyone was sending. He said they sent so much food to the soldiers; they were drowning in junk food. Everyone's writing letters, and I noticed on my side, he's in the front line, and I notice on my side, suddenly, everyone stops honking. Everyone waits in line. You know, everyone's polite because you know when we're being killed, we recognize. I always say this, that whether it's the Romans in 70 AD, the Nazis in 1939, 1945, you know, Hamas, you know, Hezbollah, the Iranians, they do not care what we think, what we believe as individual Jews. They don't care whether we're left wing or right wing.
Right. Secular,
religious,
religious,
traditional, or
a Jew
secular.
Is a Jew is a Jew. Right.
And that's the only time it seems to
civilian or military
right.
Also.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
No
they
distinction.
They don't distinguish. There's no, I always say in Auschwitz, there's only one line. And if you go back to Purim, you see the background to the Purim story is when Jews are very comfortably living in Persia, having been there for decades already and quite, you know, acculturated and mainstreamed into the society, comes an Adolf Hitler of his age by the name of Haman, who declares a complete genocide against all the Jews of the world. And that was, by the way, there's a great line, by the way, in the Tractate Megillah, which is the Talmud that deals with the story of Purim. You know, it says at one point Ahasuerus, the emperor, takes off his ring and he makes Haman the viceroy, the CEO of the empire. And he says, do what you want with the Jews. The rabbis jump in. It's one of the most powerful lines. They said that, he said, Ahasuerus giving Haman his ring had a greater impact on the Jewish people than all the prophets of Israel who told them off for what they were doing wrong. You had prophets, Jeremiah and Isaiah, and these people are incredibly connected with these beautiful words of criticism of get your act together. And we always ignored all of it.
Yeah, we didn't listen to them.
You know, Jeremiah screaming for the last three kings of Judah, like, listen to God, don't rebel against Babylon. But in the end, it ends up in a 2.5-year siege and the death of tens of thousands of people, destruction of Jerusalem, the temple, and Israel. Whereas, boom, suddenly, literally overnight, you know, this is BC before cell phones. It's not like everyone had a text message on their WhatsApp group for the Jews of Persia. But hey, guys, in 11 months, we're all going to be put to death.
Right.
And suddenly everyone stopped fighting and recognized that we have to get our act together. That sets the stage for the salvation that comes after.
Yeah, I think it's one of the, it's such a powerful story, and it's such a great example that we are capable of being unified. I think the difficulty always is the only way to do it through fear, right? Is the, and look, we all respond to fear in different ways, but we also know that fear is never a long-term solution to motivation. Right? Somebody can go and get a, God forbid, a terrible cancer diagnosis. I'm going to get healthy. I'm going to take care of myself. And all of the research points to, you know, 6 to 9 months later, they're doing the exact same lifestyle as they did before the diagnosis. So fear is never like a long-term solution to getting people to be their best selves. And I certainly see that this pattern that we have as the Jews is the only way we unify is when we're terrified that we're going to be wiped off the face of the earth. It never lasts. So what are some of the things within our mission statement that can help us unify, not under fear, but under something else?
Right. That's a perfect, that's a great point. Because anyone who's in marketing strategy, you have to always be for something, not against. I always say if Coke's motto was doesn't taste as bad as Pepsi, no one's going to buy Coca-Cola.
Right.
And anyone who, you know, most people who make major life changes, whether it's like losing their weight, the biggest motivating factor is they lose the weight and they see how good they look and how good they feel. And they're now focused on the positive outcome of what they've done. So it's never the situation you want to be in. And by the way, it doesn't necessarily work. You know, it may have saved us in Purim, but it didn't save us in the Holocaust.
Right.
People think the Jewish world was all wonderfully unified in Eastern Europe pre-Holocaust. They just do not understand that the Jewish world was rotting from within, even the religious world.
Right.
It was falling apart, the level of divisiveness and arguments. I'm not talking about religious in just a second. I'm talking about within the religious world.
Yeah.
So it's got to come, what you're pointing to is, in my opinion, a really important idea. It's got to come from top down. I say top down two things. One is leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Egoless leadership that is into truth and can inspire and focus everyone on what the real issue is, which is getting us all to focus on what we can agree on. Because when you can get Jews to actually interact and talk, right? It was a guy in Eish HaTorah who ran this program called Common Denominator.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to bring like Hashomer HaTzair Kibbutz. Hashomer HaTzair is the most left wing. These are people who in the 50s had pork chop barbecues on Yom Kippur with a picture of Joseph Stalin in the dining hall. Not really.
Yep.
And he'd bring them. This is not okay. This is 1990, so that a lot of the real hardcore anti-religious stuff had already waned. But these are not people who are religiously inclined. These are the Ashkenazi, most secular, Zionist elite kind of ideologues of the kibbutz world.
Mm-hmm.
And he put them in Me'esharim, the most cloistered, closed, self-ghettoized, ultra-Orthodox world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. These are people who never, ever deal with each other.
Mm-hmm.
All they do is like brag on each other and hear about what they're doing bad in the news. And this pork-eating Zionists trying to destroy the Jewish soul. And then these are the Haredi guys who are not serving in the army and are parasites and not paying taxes or working.
Mm-hmm.
But they put them in a room together. I watched this a couple of times. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
They look so different. The only thing they have in common is they're Jews and we're all children of Abraham and Sarah.
Right.
But you would be amazed how much, once they actually stopped yelling and screaming and sat down and talked, how much they could agree on. And the thing is, when I talk to people, I always say we got to agree to disagree on certain things.
Right.
But we got to focus on, I actually started years ago, I had this epiphany moment during Rosh Hashanah, at least I was doing something useful, years ago, probably like 10 years ago now.
Right.
And I said, and I really, as a history guy, I really got obsessed with the idea of unity. I said, we need to start a Jewish unity movement. The website is still sitting online. It's called junite.org.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's with the J-U-N-I-T-E. And the motto is two Jews, three opinions, one destiny.
Beautiful.
And I did a little bit of research. I never did anything with this site. Maybe you and I can plan. We can figure. Anyone hearing this will come up with an idea how to use it.
I'm in.
But it's really first and foremost focusing on the unified destiny of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Because regardless of who we are, what we believe, or where we live, we all as Jews are part of one family with one mission. And I focused on like three things that I think we could get virtually every Jew on the same boat on, which was first of all unity.
Okay.
They're all part of people. Second of all was
education. The hardest one of all, but okay.
Second of all was education.
Right.
Okay. And the third of all was being proactive. Jews
Right.
love fixing the world.
Right.
We're always
Yeah.
into it.
Yeah.
In the secular world, it's Jews for every cause in the world. I always say Jews for every ism, but Judaism, any cause to make the world a better place, is usually run or founded by Jews. In the religious world, we have, chesed societies and charities and this going on. So everyone wants that kind of stuff. Jews love that kind of stuff.
Right.
And we love information. We are the people of the book.
Yeah.
But you can't represent the Jewish people to, what the Jewish people represents. There's secular yeshivot in Tel Aviv where they learn Torah and Talmud as a purely intellectual pursuit without any, attachment to doing commandments like keeping Shabbat or Kashrut. But also to focus, and you're right, the hardest one is the unity one.
Right.
But it's also recognizing that we are, but it doesn't mean you have to agree. It means you have to recognize that we're all part of the same family.
Right.
And family is a
right.
great analogy I love using when I explain this, because family, you know, they always say blood is thicker than water. Any parent gets this point. I said, if you have teenagers, you get this line. You don't always like your kids, but you always love them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is definitely a good motto for the Jews. I mean, when I became part of the Jewish people, it was marrying into a family that was crazy and deeply divisive and yet is a family still and identifies as such, as we see when things get really bad. But I really think, as we wrap up this episode, turning towards Purim, one of the beautiful things we see is that we do have the ability to unify when we need to. It would just be super great to be able to unify, not just when we need to in order to save our lives, but we unify because as unified Jewish people, we can actually accomplish our mission and our purpose with ourselves, with each other, and with God so much better.
For sure. For sure. And that's where the leadership comes in. And that's what we do not have. We don't have leadership in the Torah world. We have people who
Right.
are great Torah scholars, but there's not people who say what need to be said and holistically looking at the Jewish world. They take care of their communities.
Right.
But if you had a leader, just think about in theory, someone who has the strength, because ego and strength are different things. You got to be
yep.
super tough.
Brave.
As a Jew, the two greatest traits of being a Jewish leader, because people who would have been the greatest leaders of other nations, we chew them up and spit them out. You have to be tough as nails, but you got to be diplomatic. You cannot boss Jews around. If you push Jews, they
yes.
push back. And
right.
if you're not
right.
strong, they walk all over you. That's King
right.
Saul's Hamlet-like fatal flaw.
Right.
That's his weakness.
Yeah.
But imagine if you have a leader who truly is altruistically like a Moses. Doesn't have to have the prophetic abilities of Moses, but he just has to have the ability to frame the mission of the Jewish people in a way that is inclusive, in a way that, like I said, proactivity. What is Jewish? It's not to be like, in the words of Hatikva, like everyone else. It's never
right.
going to be and will never be allowed to be like anyone else. Our mission is to create a unique people that is
but
a role model for the world.
Right, but to have a leader whose mission is unity, meaning getting everyone on as much of a common page as possible while allowing for all of our diversity would be an astonishing thing to see in the Jewish
right.
world.
Exactly. And branding the mission in a way that's the most inclusive sounding, because in the religious world, it's become about keeping religion, kosher, Shabbat, Kashrut, often at the expense of recognizing the Jewish people's responsibility towards, first of all, fellow Jews who aren't religious and obviously the rest of the world.
Right.
And in the secular world, it's about recognizing that the only way we can do that Tikkun Olam thing that is such a almost religious ideology of much of the Jewish world on the non-observant side, it's the understanding that you can't do that without being connected Jewishly. You can't represent the Jewish people to know what the Jewish people represents. We have
right.
the wisdom and knowledge and the model for how to create the best society and the best community, best society, best country, and best world possible.
Amen.
So that's something we could agree on. If we just could stop with the being so reactive and so full of fear about like what's going on today is fear. They're going to turn Israel into a fascist dictatorship. I'm going to
right.
lose my rights.
Right.
But at the same point, the right has to recognize these people are genuinely scared because
yes.
demographically they see that the country is moving religiously. It's moving towards the right politically. What makes Israel beautiful is the united colors of Benetton country that it is, due
right.
to their size, shape, and color and belief. And that,
right.
that's the beauty of the world in general.
For sure.
But it cannot be that my identity and my fulfillment has to come at the expense of yours.
Right.
It has to be that what my fulfillment, your fulfillment, if we really get past some certain superficials, are really very similar to each other, and we can do it together, and that would be unbelievable. And again,
Main
what you
main.
take out of this, if you look at the pattern, if we start tearing each other apart from inside, like we see what's going on now, I always
Yeah.
see God sitting up in heaven, so to speak, saying, "My children," and any parent knows this, you don't want your kids to disrespect you, but it hurts much more when your kids fight amongst each other.
Yeah.
Nothing's more painful to parents than seeing kids hate each other and fight.
Right.
My God saying, "You want to kill each other, my children? I'll find someone else to do it for you. I can't stand to watch you do it to each other."
So God willing, it won't get to that point. I feel like this was a perfect conversation to open up season three. I feel like this, this theme of unity and our mission and purpose. I think getting into the idea of leadership and what that could and should look like, that these are a bunch of the things that we're going to talk about over the next, episodes that we do for this season. And I'm really happy that we did this right before Purim also. So thank you so much, Rabbi Ken Spiro. Thank you everyone for listening and for joining us. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or would like more information, please just take a look at the liner notes and please share this podcast with your friends or anyone you think would be interested in these kinds of conversations. Ken, thanks so much.
Thanks again. Always great.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.